My name is Christy Boswell. I am Director of Congressional Relations at American Farm Bureau, handling the labor and immigration portfolio. One thing that I really wanted to accomplish having an immigration session this year at convention was to get outside the box a little bit on the broader immigration debate. You heard President Duvall's address this morning. Immigration and ag labor reform continues to be a priority issue for farmers and ranchers across America, and making sure we have access to a legal and stable workforce. There are a lot of we's that go into this, but because of the nature of our workforce, we are in that broader, bigger, political, emotional immigration debate. And rather than continue kind of to talk through the substance of what we need, I thought it would be great to have experts talk about that bigger picture and the players that we work with day-to-day in Washington, D.C., and in a bigger coalition, and just really what the reality is out there and the political reality of addressing this very important issue. You will see there is an open seat. Unfortunately, Miriam from the Wall Street Journal fell ill late last week, and a doctor instructed her not to travel, and with the last-minute notice, couldn't find it. Not that there would be an adequate substitute for her, but I couldn't find someone else from the media. So you will have more time with Tom and Mark here to talk through their perspectives and hopefully time for Q&A as well. So with that, I will turn it over to Tom Hertz with USDA.
Thank you, Christy. Thanks for the invitation, and thank you all for coming. There's still a couple seats up in here. I hate to see people standing to hear this news. Okay. All right. So I am Tom Hertz. I'm from the Economic Research Service, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, from that great agricultural state of Washington, D.C. I play with data. I don't play in the dirt. I don't have to deal with workers, weather, weeds, or any of the actual problems involved here. But I do know something about the farm labor data, and I'm hoping to give you an overview of what we know about what's happening on the immigration front from a factual point of view. I won't not really in a position to talk about immigration policy since I work for the government. But hopefully we'll have some discussion about that, and I can chip in with some facts and figures along the way. So the context that this debate is being held in is a decline in immigration from Mexico since 2007 that has led to an aging of the U.S. farm workforce and widespread concerns about shortages of farm workers. So what I'll start with is some basic slides on the trends in immigration from Mexico to show you what that decline looks like, how big it is. I have some data on the demographics of just the crop farm workforce. I don't have the livestock numbers up, but I think there are concerns in the dairy industry in particular, but certainly fruits and vegetables is the biggest area of concern. I've got some data on wages, which are indeed rising somewhat more rapidly than in the past, though they have been rising for some time. It's not entirely new that wages are rising. And one thing I want to emphasize is that the wage increases seem to be driven in large part by rising wages for farm labor contractors. That's the sector where the wage growth seems to be the fastest. And then I've got some notes on how farmers are responding to higher wages, and indeed H-2A employment, for all the difficulties of working within that system, is the escape valve that seems to be keeping many people afloat here. So H-2A employment is rising rapidly. And interestingly, farmers, as always, are endlessly inventive, and they have managed through changing productivity, through finding ways to increase productivity, and through some good output price trends, especially in fruits. As a result of rising productivity and favorable prices in at least some sectors, labor costs as a share of income, gross income, or as a share of expenses are not rising. So on that front, the industry as a whole is not seeing a labor cost pressure. The industry as a whole, I emphasize. We'll come back to what that average for the industry means versus for some particular crops. So I also have some economic simulation results about how some hypothetical policy changes might affect agriculture. And I stress hypothetical. These are not policies that we're recommending or policies that we are saying are likely. We're just sort of picked some policies out of the realm of possibility. And then we used a fancy macro model of the entire U.S. economy to investigate the effects of these two hypothetical scenarios. So the first scenario is a liberalization of the H-2A program rules leading to a further increase in the use of H-2A. And the second scenario was an enforcement type of scenario leading to relatively large reductions in unauthorized immigrant populations. And I probably, before I go there, I should have emphasized the disclaimer at the beginning, which is I'm speaking not on behalf of the USDA. I'm speaking as a researcher who works for the government, but I'm not speaking for the government. And if I say anything stupid, don't blame my bosses, okay? All right, so here on the left is an interesting graph going all the way back to 1850, which is perhaps unnecessary, but it is an interesting fact that the Mexican immigrant population in the U.S. really took off around 1970, rising from around 1 million to around 13 million, and it peaked in 2007 and has since declined pretty steadily year by year to a current estimated number of 11.7 million total Mexican-born individuals living in the U.S., legal, illegal, employed, unemployed, everybody. And then the right-hand graph is an estimate of the number of unauthorized Mexican immigrants. Again, whether they're employed or not is not calculated. It's just all unauthorized Mexican immigrant population. That also peaked at a guesstimate of 6.9 million in 2007, falling to about 5.8 million most recently. It appears to have stabilized. The decline appears to have stabilized. And, of course, this is of concern because a chunk of the crop farm workforce is indeed unauthorized Mexican immigrants. So that's what this next slide talks about. In that first panel, the third row, you see the estimate. Again, these are for crop farm workers only. This is from the National Agricultural Workers Survey. A number of great interest is the share who are unauthorized. That seems to have stabilized at around 50%. It hasn't changed much in the past few years. And I put this number up, and a lot of people scoff and say, oh, it's got to be higher than that. You must be undercounting. They won't admit to being unauthorized, et cetera. But I don't actually think that's true. I think what you're looking at is an average for the entire crop farm sector. Yes, there are a lot of unauthorized workers in particular industries, especially if you look at newcomers. In fact, if I slice these data, if I ask for people who have only less than 2 years of experience in agriculture, so they're relatively new, they're young, and they're working in fruits and vegetables, especially fruits, I can get unauthorized shares as high as 97%, which tells me that it's not a problem with the survey. If 97% of this group are willing to say, yeah, I'm unauthorized, then I don't think the survey is having a real serious problem in finding unauthorized workers. It may be that when NAS, National Agricultural Statistical Service, approaches farm employers and says, hey, we want you to answer the farm labor survey, maybe some of you have participated in that. Not all of the farmers agree to do that. I think it's about a 50-55% response rate. And it could be that some farm operators who use large numbers of unauthorized workers are a little antsy about answering the survey. So there could be a bias in that regard. But like I say, if you can find a group for which 97% of them say, yeah, I'm unauthorized, it doesn't seem like there's a huge bias. So I actually think those numbers are probably about right. And they represent the fact that in many labor-intensive fruits and vegetables, such as in here in Arizona, there shouldn't be any unauthorized workers, right? With E-Verify in Arizona, if people know of holes in the E-Verify system that could allow large numbers of unauthorized workers to work on Arizona farms, I'd be interested to hear that in the Q&A. Anyway, for whatever they're worth, the measured share of the crop farm workforce that is unauthorized appears to be stable at around 50%. But like I say, it's much, much higher in certain industries. There aren't too many unauthorized workers in grain, in the Corn Belt, stuff like that. So you got to remember that it's an average across many different types of operations. So the share who are foreign-born altogether and the share who are Mexican has held steady since comparing these two periods of 2007-09 on the one hand and 2013-2014 on the other. But where we do see significant changes because of the slowdown in new immigration is the average age. The existing workforce is still here. They're getting older. They've gotten older by about 2 years over the past 6 or 7 years. And that's obviously of concern. On the other hand, and you look at the share who are 55 or older, that's gone from 11% to 14%. These are statistically significant changes. So that's a, you know, clearly farm work being manual labor, you know, you can't do it at too advanced of an age. On the other hand, it also means that the level of experience is increasing. So your workforce in crop agriculture is more experienced, and that should be of some benefit. And they also have been with their current farm employer for a little longer time, about 7 years up from about six. So they're a little more bound to the, you know, a little more tied to their current employers and a little more experienced. Not significant changes in levels of education or English language ability. And yes, significant changes in the sort of the share of the immigrant workers who are settled, who are not migrating. That's gone up quite a bit from 74% in the first period to 84%. And the share who are brand new to the U.S. has, of course, gone way down with the drop in immigration. So just 2% of the immigrant workers are recent immigrants of the within the last year. So here's the first slide I have on wage data. This is not, I have another slide which unfortunately comes at the very end. My slides are a little out of order. I'll come back to that. But this is using the quarterly census of employment and wages, the QCEW, which is not a data source that people use too often for agriculture because it doesn't cover the entire industry. It only covers farm employers who are bound to pay unemployment insurance. In Arizona, that's everybody. In California, that's everybody. But in many states, if you have fewer than 20 workers for 20 weeks or some rule like that, you don't have to pay UI, and that means you don't have to report to your state labor department, and that means you're not in this data set. So they estimate that it covers 85% of the hired farm workforce. By the way, everything I'm talking about is hired workers. I'm not talking about proprietors or self-employed or family members or anything like that. I'm just talking about hired workers. So anyway, but the data are rich in the sense that they cover a lot of industries with a lot of specificity, and they go back a ways to 2002. And you can see these vertical bars are annual percent changes. So in the first half of 2016, the last number there, 4.5% higher wages in the first half of 2016 compared to the first half of 2015. I always do, you know, first half to the first half of the previous year. So it isn't that they grew 4.8 and then another 4.5. They're growing at an annual rate of 4.8% in one period, at 4.5% in the other period. But basically, for the last four half years, weekly earnings have been growing at better than 4.5% annual rate. And that is a little higher than the long-run trend. You can see the red line is the long-run trend, and it's gone from about 3% a year to it's creeping up towards 4% a year. And the past 2 years are indeed, they do stand out. It's not unprecedented. We've had periods where wages rose by even higher amounts. You can see the spikes in various years there. And it's also worth noting that wages were really moderated by the Great Recession, not because agriculture slowed down, agriculture powered through the recession quite well, but because the other industries that employ the same population, construction, et cetera, dramatically slowed down. So that really held wage growth in check for a few years there in 2008, 9, 10. All right, so this graph focuses on the sector called support activities for crop production, which includes farm labor contractors, separate industry people who bring contract workers to your fields. And you can see 5 and 6% growth rates, also above the long-run trend. That long-run trend is also higher than for agriculture overall. It's at 4%, the long-run trend, and the recent data are on the 5 to 6% range. And then what I do is I look within that sector. You have these sub-activities. So the first row is the whole sector, the graph you just saw. I'm looking at 2014 to 2016 at an annual rate. So for the past 2 years, what's been the annual rate of earnings inflation, earnings cost increases for each of these subsectors? And overall, it's been 5.9%. The most recent average weekly earnings from January to June of 2016 were $553 a week. And you can see some other, so some fairly important sectors. Post-harvest crop activities is a pretty big sector. That's gone up at 5.7%. This is the really big one, 7% increase for farm labor contractors and crew leaders. And that's roughly half of the overall sector, 167,000 workers that are captured in the QCEW. There are many more that are not captured because the coverage of this sector is poor. Many farm labor contractors are not obligated to pay UI, so they're not in these data. So it's a little hard to know if this is representative or not, but it probably is. My guess is it's fairly representative, just not complete coverage. I do note that farm management services, although it's a small sector, so it doesn't make much difference overall, those costs are also increasing, almost 6% a year. You can also see that there doesn't seem to be much going on in support activities for animal production. That hasn't seen much cost increase. So what are farmers doing in response to these wage increases? Well, they're using the H-2A program, like it or not. There has been a 106% increase in national H-2A certifications by the Department of Labor since the middle of that graph, since 2001. So that's going from 80,000 to the most recent data that just came out, over 160,000, something like 165,000 H-2A workers were certified in fiscal 2016. And I also bring in the visas granted line. That, so there's various ways to measure the size of the H-2A program. Positions certified is greater than visas granted because some of those certified positions are not filled. Farmers get certifications but don't always use every single one of them. But more to the point, you can use the same person for two different certified positions. So a visa is a person, but they can fill more than one position sometimes. So that those numbers are lower, but the trend is very similar. So something like 100 and probably, if I could extend the visas line to 2016, it would probably be about 120,000 actual individuals were granted H-2A visas in the last fiscal year. And that's, again, roughly double what it was 5 years ago. So this is the graph that shows that despite the cost increases, farmers have managed to contain labor costs as a share of either expenses or income. So the top line is the fruits, vegetables, and nuts sector. And you show a slight decrease in the share of labor costs. That includes contract labor costs and hired labor and fringe benefits and cash wages. So as a share of expenses, it does not appear to be rising. There's a little uptick in 2015. There might be a little uptick in 2016 if I had the ARMS data, the USDA Agricultural Resource Management Survey, which I bet some of you have labored through. It's a rather lengthy questionnaire. So when we get that data, we'll see if the red line on top is still trending up. But the long-run trend is not up. It seems to be a little bit down. That's labor costs as a share of expenses. What that says is, yeah, labor costs are rising, but so are your other expenses, right? So that's perhaps cold comfort. But more relevant to your margin is what's the share of labor costs in gross income. And that is actually falling pretty steadily in fruits and vegetables. I think mostly in fruits. I have some price data coming up in a minute. And then those are the most labor-intensive sectors that we can identify in ARMS, and then I have the similar lines for all farms. And there it's a slight downward trend as well. So like I say, productivity marches on, and some of the particular methods for dealing with rising labor costs, as I'm sure you know, you can mechanize, and ever-increasing technological research has led to more and more possibilities for mechanization. They keep saying this crop can't be mechanized, that crop can't be mechanized, and then sure enough, a few years later, somebody figures out a way to do it. So I expect that will continue apace. There's also sort of partial mechanical assistance, hydraulic platforms in the orchards to keep people from having to run up and down ladders, all kinds of conveyor belts and tricks you can use to to shorten the distance that you have to carry all these heavy produce. So all that stuff is being adopted increasingly, and that has helped raise productivity and contain total labor costs as a share of either your total cash expenses or your gross income. So this shows NAS price indices for all the fruit and tree nut commodities and also all the vegetable and melon commodities. It's pretty noisy, as you can see, but fruits especially, the trend is very positive. Fruit prices have steadily risen. Maybe in the last couple of years they've come up and down, but clearly since 07 they have marched upward quite a bit. That's the blue line. The dotted line is sort of a smoothed version of the blue line, just to see what the straight line trend looks like. And for vegetables and melons, it looks like the prices are A, much more volatile, and B, the trend is not so positive. But it doesn't seem like the prices are the problem. So the last section is this report that we put out, my colleague Steven Zonizer from the USDA and I, in cooperation with some computable general equilibrium modelers, Peter Dixon and Maureen Rimmer from Australia. So this is a macroeconomic model of the entire U.S. economy, and what we do is, that's the name of the model, the U.S. Applied General Equilibrium Model, USAGE, and we employed it to study the effects of hypothetical policy changes. And again, the disclaimer, these policy changes are hypothetical. They're for illustrative purposes only. It's not intended as a comment on policy directions, past, present, or future. So the first thing to note about the simulations is that these results pertain to the long run. So these are not shocks that would be felt immediately. You sort of let the economy settle down, and you look 15 years after the policy change. So you look at what's the real long-run impact of these various scenarios that we're investigating. The first simulation imagines expanding the H-2A program by 156,000, which at the time we wrote this thing meant tripling the H-2A program. Now it just means doubling the H-2A program. Okay, so this sort of tells you the effect of H-2A on moderating farm wages. And the second simulation, as I mentioned, is an enforcement scenario, where we imagine reducing the projected future size of the unauthorized farm workforce the unauthorized workforce, both farm and non-farm. So this is sort of an across-the-board, heavy-duty enforcement scenario that, in the long run, reduces that number by 40%. So almost half of the current and projected future unauthorized population is somehow removed from the U.S. economy. And these are the numerical impacts of these two scenarios. So we first look at fruits and tree nuts, the labor-intensive, well, not tree nuts, but fruits and vegetables, the most labor-intensive and nurseries sectors. The H-2A program, by adding 156,000 farm workers, would allow output to rise by 1% to 2%. Everything is presented as a range because we use different possible parameters depending on how strong you think the employment responds to wage changes and how easily farmers can substitute capital for labor and this kind of thing. So we have a range of estimates, and we think that the H-2A expansion would allow fruit, tree nut, veggie, and nursery output to grow by 1 or 2 points, exports to grow by more than that, 1.7 to 3.2. These effects are much smaller for the other agricultural sectors, which are much less labor intensive. And then the enforcement scenario, which the 40% number works out to about 5.8 million farm and non-farm workers, that predictably has a negative impact on output. 2 to 5% for the labor-intensive sectors, 2.5 to almost 9% or more than 9% for exports of labor-intensive crops. And I would guess that these are fairly conservative estimates. The impact might be a little more dramatic than that. The model is unable to drill down to the most labor-intensive, the most unauthorized immigrant-heavy sectors. So those sectors may be a little underplayed in this model, and that's where the most dramatic impacts would be felt. And the effects are negative, but not as negative in the less labor-intensive sectors, field grains, et cetera. Finally, under these two scenarios, we also look at what would happen to employment and earnings per job. H2A employment would increase employment, as you might imagine. It would dramatically increase H2A employment by 30% because we're adding H2A workers. And some of what would happen is that existing authorized immigrants, green card holders, citizens who are nonetheless immigrant, foreign born, they would be squeezed out a little bit by an increase of H2A workers. That's that minus 5.7%. Overall, wages in agriculture would fall by about 4.4%. Some of that would fall on legal permanent residents. That's the minus 3.4%. But the most dramatic impact of bringing in many more H2As is reducing wages for the people who are in competition with them, the unauthorized. So remaining unauthorized workers in states where they're still able to work would take the biggest hit in their earnings at about 10%. And then the enforcement scenario would have, again, the negative consequences for agriculture. Total agricultural employment might fall by 3 to 5%. For the authorized, they would be able to fill the jobs that the removed unauthorized left behind. So the authorized immigrants, legal permanent residents, green card holders, would be able to fill some of those jobs, and then the unauthorized would bear the brunt of the effects of removing many unauthorized workers. So that's the minus 30 to 38%. And wages would rise by about 4 to 10% over what would have happened if we didn't do the policy. All of these numbers are comparing the policy 15 years down the road to what we think 15 years down the road would look like without that policy. Okay, so you have to first project the regular economy 15 years forward, and then you say, okay, how different would it be if we had this particular policy in place? And lastly, although increased enforcement removes many unauthorized immigrants, that would put upward pressure on the earnings of those who are left behind. And that's that final row. So I'm going to skip these conclusions real quick. I'll come back to them. I just want to put up one more graph. This is another estimate of what's happened to wages. These are annual numbers from the Farm Labor Survey. The 2016 numbers just came out for the Farm Labor Survey full year. This is the crop and livestock non-supervisory category. So that's these numbers are a little bit lower than the QCEW shows, probably because the QCEW includes all occupations in the industry, so it includes managerial wages, back office, et cetera, whereas this is field workers and crop, and livestock workers, the actual agricultural laborers, not the supporting occupations in the industry. And it's a different survey, so it doesn't have to agree entirely. So anyway, those numbers are both at about 4%. Again, higher than the trend, which shows to be about 3%, but not completely unprecedented. And then if you're in the H2A business, this is the map that matters. These are the current, these are the next year's FY17, or I guess this current year, AWARs, the adverse effect wage rates. These are based on the farm labor survey that I just showed you. You can look at your state and see what you got to pay your H2As. The overall average, I believe, is about $12.20. And you can see where the wages are highest. That's where you're required to pay H2As the most. The idea is that you're not supposed to bring H2As in such a way that you would lower the average wage. You got to bring them in at the average wage so that you don't lower the average wage. The idea being that you don't want to have negative impact on existing workers, including those who are U.S. citizens. So I apologize for these being out of order, but let me just summarize. Reduced immigration from Mexico and renewed economic growth have most likely are the causes of higher than average wage increases that we've seen in the last 2 years. And as I said, it's driven to a large extent by the farm labor contract sector. Wrong direction. However, overall labor costs appear to be trending downwards as a share of gross income or expenses even in labor-intensive sectors. And that has been assisted by rising prices for many labor-intensive fruits. And we don't know what will happen in 2016. I don't know what the data show for that, but generally it's clear that productivity increases are offsetting some of these wage increases. And again, these are industry averages. So higher labor costs and reduced labor supply may still be problems for some farm operations. And I apologize for the cautious wording of that. I'm sure there are some people out there who know damn well that labor costs are a problem for their particular industries. And I don't mean to say otherwise. I just, this is government speak. The macroeconomic modeling confirms that expansion of guest worker programs would indeed contain wage increases and lead to expanded agricultural outputs. I mean, that's not rocket science, but we try to put some numbers on that. And of course, the opposite, enhanced immigration enforcement would indeed raise labor costs and lead to reduced employment, output, and exports. And I guess that's it. So why don't we have Mark respond, and then we'll have a Q&A. Thanks for your attention.
So can you hear me all right? Yeah. My name is Mark Delich. I'm the Director of Congressional Affairs for Ford U.S. My previous life up to this past June, for the previous decade, I worked for Senator McCain from Arizona handling border and immigration issues. So it's good to be back home, but now visiting in a kind of different capacity. At Forward, we are an organization, an advocacy organization that was started in 2013 by leaders in the tech industry like Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates to advocate and push for immigration reform. You know, our founders, and I'm sure many people in this room, recognize and appreciate that. Can you hear me right? Better? Okay. Recognize that, you know, it's a country we were founded by immigrants. Unless, you know, somebody in this room is a Native American, somebody themselves or some of their family came from somewhere else. And as an organization, we recognize that the benefits that immigrants bring, and we want to continue and promote and see that continue in the future. One in four small businesses in the United States are founded by immigrants. 40% of Fortune 500 companies in the United States, Fortune 500 companies are either run by immigrants or children of immigrants. So we recognize that the folks that come into this country, as opposed to dialogue today, we see them as a net benefit. And we want to continue to promote that. To do so, since 2013, we've organized, and we're in about 22 states currently, working with groups like the Farm Bureau, Conference of Catholic Bishops, evangelical groups, law enforcement groups, anybody that wants to continue to promote and try to fix our immigration system, we want to work with. In addition, in D.C., we have traditional lobbying efforts. We meet with members of Congress and the staffs, work with them, try to educate them where we can, and convince them that this is a problem that needs fixing. And when we talk to those offices, we really have three kind of broad principles that we stick to. We want to increase security and illegal immigration. I don't think there's many folks who disagree with the desire to do that. In addition, we want to make sure that we have a robust and viable both guest worker program for H-2As and H-1Bs so that when market forces dictate, employers can bring in the employees that they need. They're not competing with, Native American workforces. But in addition, we want to maintain current levels of immigrants, permanent immigrants, so that people that want to come into this country have the ability to do so and continue to contribute as people have done since our founding. And, you often hear when people talk about this, we need to fix our broken immigration system, and a lot of times that starts and stops with border security. When we talk to offices, when I go into a congressional office and we talk about what's needed, almost every response is, we want to do that. We want to fix the H-2A program. We want to fix the ag program. We want to fix this, but we need to secure our border. And I'm not going to say that our border is not in need of fixing, but I will say there are additional problems that need to be addressed. And part of that broken system is, for example, when you work with the H-2A program, I'm not going to tell anyone in this room how you handle that. I don't have to do that. But it's been told to me many times in my previous job and now, the bureaucratic nature of it, the fickle nature of it, you have the planning and man hours that you have to do to comply and then hope that everything's approved ahead of time so you can get the labor force that you need in. I want to consider that a program or system that's working. You may have to, you may be forced to work with it, but I want to say that it should be working how we would like to see it working. In addition, for people that want to come in the country illegally, people that make every attempt to do so, in many cases, depending on your sending country, you may have to wait 5, 10, 20 years to be able to apply to get a green card. I don't think that's, you know, a viable system that people would consider as working. And, you know, Miriam's not here, but if you've had a chance to read any of her writing, and this kind of goes with some of the discussion that Tom had, we're seeing just from the improved Mexican economy, there's less Mexicans coming, which means that in many sectors of the economy, whether it's ag or hospitality or construction, the workers aren't there. I mean, even with increased wages, those industries are having, the employers in those industries are having a very tough time to find needed labor. And that, as we look forward going into 2017, the conversation is changing, both with the incoming administration and with some members in Congress, of not how do we fix a system and kind of get labor to employers that need it that benefit Americans, but what is the level of immigration that we actually need? And Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas recently penned an op-ed in the New York Times, and he wrote that he believes President-elect Trump not only has a mandate to end illegal immigration, but to end low-skill immigration in the United States. And I would assume, like, I'm not going to tell people in this room how to think, but I would assume from the conversation I've had that the idea that we're not looking to fix the H-2A program or fix an ag labor program, but to actually say we don't need that labor force to come to the United States would be troubling. In addition, as we looking forward to 2017, the most pressing issue that we see forward is trying to determine what President-elect Trump is going to do with regards to the executive action on immigration. 3 years ago, President Obama, through an executive order, provided deferred action and work authorization to approximately 750,000 individuals, people that we call Dreamers, folks that were brought here by their parents, undocumented immigrants were brought here by their parents through no fault of their own, and those protections were extended to them. During the campaign, President-elect Trump indicated that one of his first actions would be to eliminate that executive action, and I think most Republicans, given how it was implemented through the executive action as opposed to legislatively, support that. You know, that's not the way that immigration reform is supposed to take place. However, since the election, President-elect Trump has stated that he wants to find a solution for these young people and sort of softened his tone. And I think a lot of members of Congress also want to try to find something that can be done that does not take these men and women, out of the workforce, out of school, and contributing to the United States, in a legal fashion for the first time they've been able to in their lives. And, luckily we've had members of Congress, both Senator Durbin and Senator Graham, have offered legislation to do just that. And I think, for folks that want to find a solution to do it the right way, i.e. legislatively, that gives us an option to do so. And finally, what we're probably going to see coming up, and I'm sure everyone's seen this in the news or I've heard this the past year, likely to see, an increase in border security spending, particularly physical infrastructure, some sort of wall, something along those lines. The president-elect has the authority to do that. The question is, how much money does he get to do that? There are ways that they can reappropriate funds, so I would imagine that as soon as he's sworn in, that will start. which I think gives us an opportunity in the sense that over the past decade, border security has increased. As I mentioned, I'm not going to say it's secure, but we've gone from around 2000, from around 1 million apprehensions a year to now it's around 400,000 apprehensions. Here in the Tucson sector, we've gone from 600,000 apprehensions to around 80,000 apprehensions. Now, that's not a perfect number. It's not a perfect stat to estimate the flow of people that are coming or people that don't get apprehended, but it's the best stat that we have. And that is in part for two big reasons. One, the improved Mexican economy, and also We've increased the Border Patrol from about 10,000 agents to 20,000 agents. We've built 653 miles of fencing. We have, here, especially here in Tucson, we have integrated fixed towers throughout the desert, throughout, I think there's 25 or so integrated fixed towers that help inform agents of where people are coming across and then direct them to be apprehended. Drones, UAVs, et cetera, all that's had a tremendous effect to limit the ability for people to come in the country illegally. What we've seen, and particularly in the Rio Grande Valley and in Texas, is folks that are coming in and essentially turning themselves over, people that are making a legal asylum claim. I don't consider that a border security problem when you have 10 groups, 10, 15 kids, young people, families turning themselves over. It ties up border security resources, and it's a problem that needs to be addressed, but it's not what I would consider a, you know, an insecure border. So with additional infrastructure, with this new administration coming in, with probably more personnel, I think we can get to the point that we can actually consider the border secure. We're not there yet, but we're close, and I assume this administration is going to focus on that. That will allow us to kind of get through what I call the border security bottleneck that prevents us from fixing, you know, the ag worker program. It prevents us from fixing all these other issues that there's pretty broad consensus on. You know, there's broad consensus that for the undocumented immigrants, I think I missed a priority, but that's actually a third priority, so I apologize. there's upwards of 75% consensus that people want to see for the 11 million people that are here and undocumented, if they present themselves, pass background check, pay back taxes, pay fees, and learn English, that they should have a chance to earn legalization or a path to citizenship. You know, we encourage that. We would like to see that. And getting through the border security, solving that problem, will allow us to get to those other issues. And finally, just wrapping up, as at Forward, we're not ag policy experts by any means, but what we try to do is partner with folks like the Farm Bureau so that we can help elevate those voices. We can help partner with the folks that we have in the field throughout the states that can coordinate with you. And, you know, I can't underestimate, for those that want to see the problem fixed, how important and effective it is when you reach out and you talk to your members of Congress because they listen, whether it's through social media, whether that's sending letters or emails, whether it's attending town halls, whatever it is, particularly with your group, for folks that live in traditionally red states, talk to members that may not have, you know, a pressing desire for a variety of reasons to work on this issue. When you reach out to them and you talk to them, they listen and it makes a big difference. So if you are interested in doing so, whether it's through the Farm Bureau or contacting Ford, I would encourage you to do so. So thank you for listening and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both very much, and we do have time for questions. Just real quickly, wrapping up kind of both what Tom and Mark have said and how that applies to Farm Bureau policy and the work that we're doing. You know, Tom laid out the nature of our workforce. And even though wages are increasing, which takes a lot of the misperceptions that we want cheap labor, it's not about cheap labor. It's about access to a legal and stable workforce, something that our farmers deserve and our consumers deserve, and ensuring that we have a system that provides that. And also talking not just about the border security component. Agriculture is very unique, and Farm Bureau is very unique in that we have policy relating to all kind of three major elements, what I call three-legged stool of immigration reform. We have the border security enforcement component. That is an important piece of any responsible immigration reform debate. Also included in that, though, is electronic verification, which you heard Tom mention. American Farm Bureau and agricultural generally opposes mandatory E-Verify until we have a solution that ensures agriculture has access to a legal workforce. And so as those enforcement proposals like Mark eloquently, kind of the border security bottleneck that is happening in the policy debate, as those discussions evolve and E-Verify comes comes to the forefront of those, we are going to be very concerned and working to leverage that discussion to gain access to a workable visa program and also an adjustment of status for our current workers. The second leg of the stool is that legal immigration system, making sure people can come in and fill these jobs legally, that the legal economic immigration system works for our economics. And then the third leg of the stool is the undocumented piece, and that's very complicated. It's very emotional. Like Mark said, there's a lot of broad support, contrary to a lot of the rhetoric you hear, of finding a responsible solution to that population. Half of our workforce, at least, is in that kind of bucket, and we need to make sure these experienced workers can gain an adjustment of status and remain in the United States and work legally. And so you both speakers, I think, articulated the different elements of where agriculture fits into this and something that we're facing going into 2017.